Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Skip Horak, whose new book is The Other Joseph. We'll also hear from historian Adam Rothman, author of Beyond Freedom's Reach, A Kidnapping in the Twilight of Slavery. Rothman is an associate professor of history at Georgetown University. His special area of expertise is the history of slavery. His first book was Slave Country, American Expansion and the Origin of the Deep South. In his new book, he gives us a microhistory, drawn from the last days of slavery called Beyond Freedom's Reach, A Kidnapping in the Twilight of Slavery. Adam Rothman, it's a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us about Rose Herrera and her time in Louisiana. This is such a dramatic story, and she began life in Pointe-Coupee Parish and came to New Orleans in 1853, what you call arguably the worst year in the city's history. So set the stage for us of this story.
Well, that's exactly right. Rose Herrera was born in Pointe-Coupee Parish in the 1830s, middle of the Jacksonian era. She was owned by a man named Octave LeBlanc, a sugar planter, who sold his plantation in the early 1850s and moved to New Orleans, where he became a merchant. And he brought Rose and several other of the people that he owned to New Orleans with him. They arrive in New Orleans in 1853, which is the Great Yellow Fever year, killing thousands of people in New Orleans. So that must have been a rude introduction for her. She was about 18 years old when she got to New Orleans. And so she lived in New Orleans for nearly a decade before the Civil War broke out. And one thing we know about her life, really from the records of her being bought and sold, is that she had children. And we know from her own testimony that when she got to New Orleans, she found a husband, a free man of color named George Herrera. A lot of what we think we know about her life in New Orleans, we can really just get from the context, what it was probably like to be a slave there. Because so much of her life is just fragmentary. But we do know that she lived in New Orleans during the Civil War, that she had four children, and that in the middle of the war, those children were taken to Cuba by her owner.
And that's what makes this so complicated, because her final owners, the DeHarts, were part of this migration to Cuba after the Civil War. And so her children were slaves in another country after the institution was actually abolished in the United States.
That's correct. It's really an extraordinary story. In 1862, after the Union Army had come in to capture New Orleans, a lot of Confederates fled the city. Some of them go deeper into the Confederacy, but some of them leave the country altogether. They go to Europe. Some of them go to Mexico. Some of them go to Cuba. The DeHarts end up in Cuba. And in January of 1863, they take three of Rose's children with them. So as slavery crumbles in New Orleans under the pressure of the Union Army and changes in the law, Rose Herrera's children really are beyond freedom's reach. They're stranded. They're marooned in Cuba, a place where slavery continues to exist. So the question for their mother, for Rose, is, how do I get them back?
And she fought. She fought hard.
Oh, she fights really hard. Now, you know, it's not like Liam Neeson and Taken or anything like that. But what she does is really extraordinary for her own moment. Mm-hmm. She finds herself a lawyer, and she actually, when her former owner's wife, Mary DeHart, returns to New Orleans, she gets Mary DeHart thrown in jail for having kidnapped her three children. And then the case sort of works its way through the court system in New Orleans. So it's quite amazing, really unprecedented, to see the mother of three slave children basically going after her former owner for having kidnapped them. It's really a sign of the revolution of emancipation during the Civil War.
So how did you come across this story?
Completely by accident.
I love that. I always love it when that happens.
I mean, this is the greatest thing about doing research as a historian. You just really never know what you're going to find once you get into the archives. I was doing research for a bigger book about New Orleans as a cosmopolitan city in the 19th century, and I was especially interested in the connection between New Orleans and Havana, really sister cities, during the 19th century. And I happened to come across a congressional report on the rumor that was spreading around the United States in 1866 that newly freed people were being kidnapped and sold into slavery, Cuba and Brazil, the last bastions of slavery in the Americas. And it turned out that most of the material in this report had to do with Rose Herrera's children. And when I came across it, I thought, I need to know more about this. And 5 years later, it turned into a book.
Wow. What archives were you using?
Oh, I used a lot of different archives. I used archives in Washington, D.C., the Library of Congress and the National Archives. I used the great archives in New Orleans, the Historic New Orleans Collection, and the City Archives in the New Orleans Public Library, the Tulane Archives. I used the Catholic Church Archives from Baton Rouge and New Orleans, which contain a lot of information about the genealogy of enslaved people and their descendants. And I also found a way to get to Cuba and poked around in the National Archives in Havana, which was really an amazing experience.
Ah, that's great. So what's happened to the book about New Orleans in the 19th century? Is that still on the way?
It's on a back burner right now.
Yeah.
But I'm really eager to get back to it because the history of New Orleans, as you well know, is just absolutely fascinating from start to finish. I feel like there's more stories like this that still have to be told.
And seemingly endless.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing you do, this is so interesting to me, is you really bring home the brutality of kidnapping, that it's just the whole idea that someone comes and snatches you away, and that crime is what underlies all of slavery. And I think of Mike Ross's The Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case, which is different, but still a kidnapping, and how immensely readable these scholarly stories become because of that.
Well, thanks for saying that. And Mike Ross's book is a wonderful book. It's amazing that two books about kidnapping in mid-19th century New Orleans can actually be so different and tell quite different stories. You know, we know, I think, that kidnapping was an important part of the history of American slavery, and certainly 12 Years a Slave and the story of Solomon Northrop has driven home for a lot of people. But Northrop's story is really just the tip of the iceberg. For throughout the history of slavery, from Africans being kidnapped and enslaved in West and West Central Africa to free people of color in the northern states being dragged into slavery to free people of color in the South being re-enslaved, to the fears of re-enslavement after emancipation. Kidnapping, I think, really captures the tremendous trauma and terror that Africans and people of African descent really had to endure in the age of American slavery. I think kidnapping really dramatizes and crystallizes that tremendous sense of fear.
Well, and the other thing you bring home is that it's the strength of family ties, because you talk about how the desire to be reunited with one's loved ones is really the primary moving force when you're trying to recover from something like this and when you're seeking emancipation. And I don't think you can make a better case for that than one with a mother and her children.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I do think Rose Herrera's case really emphasizes that point. We know that slavery put tremendous pressure on the families of enslaved people. Just the experience of being bought and sold, forced migration through the domestic slave trade. We know that families were really torn up. But, you know, enslaved people found ways to hold on to their children, their parents, their loved ones, you know, even under this tremendous pressure. You know, once emancipation rolls back the tide of slave owners' power, those family ties emerge as some of the most crucial building blocks of community and society for newly freed people. And I think that's something that Rose Herrera's story really conveys.
Now, your last book, Slave Country, talks about how fundamental slavery was to American expansion in the South. And it's a kind of larger canvas for you. And you call this book a microhistory. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what a microhistory really is.
A microhistory is a way of really humanizing and dramatizing big and important themes in history. And I think it's especially important in the history of slavery, because for a long time, the historians of slavery have operated in really what we call social history, cobbling together lots of information about a wide variety of people to paint a general portrait of what slavery must have been like. But with the exception of a few very famous people like Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman, we really don't know much about the lives of individual enslaved people. It's very hard to write their biographies. So what microhistory allows you to do is really home in on individuals, people with names and lives and histories of their own. And I think it really fleshes out the history of slavery and emancipation in a very personal and a very humane sort of way.
So how do you feel about her after writing this book? You've spent a lot of time investigating her life and conjecturing about it. So what kind of person do you really think she was?
I think she was a tremendously loving and determined mother. It's very hard to get a sense of the interior character of people like Rose Herrera, for whom the historical record only leaves fragments behind. Now, she didn't leave a memoir. She didn't write letters. So we only catch glimpses of her. But what we do know is that she fought for the return of her children in an incredibly determined and savvy kind of way. So I admire her, and I think that she really is an inspiration.
Yeah. Well, she was for me. I thought it was a really wonderful book. We've been talking with Adam Rothman, whose compelling new book is Beyond Freedom's Reach, A Kidnapping and the Twilight of Slavery. You can meet him at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival when he appears on a panel, Sensational New Orleans Kidnapping Cases. That's Saturday, March 28th at 1 at the Hotel Montleon's Queen Anne Ballroom, along with Jessica Marie Johnson and Michael Ross. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Skip Horak was born in New Orleans and grew up in Covington, Louisiana. He's a true Southern writer, from the exquisite short stories in his first collection, Southern Cross, to the historical novel The Eden Hunter, and now in his very contemporary novel of American life, The Other Joseph. He teaches at Florida State University. Hi, Skip. I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. I really appreciate it.
Now, The Other Joseph is a real lost and found story, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel that way. How do you mean it? In what sense?
It's the story of so many of the things we lose in life, these two brothers. Tell us about them.
Yeah, you know, I think that I had such a great childhood and the best parents in the world, but I think all children, maybe especially young boys, have these kind of orphan fantasies, you know, these kind of, what would it be like to be Huck Finn? And, you know, it's hard to kind of reverse engineer the inspiration for a book, but I kind of think it maybe came from that, to sort of imagine what that would really look like, to have a man who had kind of lost everything, and, you know, how sad that could be on one end, but also how much sort of potential that gives them to kind of do anything once they get spurred into action by whatever emotion, whatever reason. So, you know, in some ways I kind of see him as, you know, Huck Finn if he was to have waited, you know, 15 years to get on the raft, you know.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the title, The Other Joseph.
Well, you know, to be honest, it's so funny how sometimes things happen by accident. I had a Louisiana narrator, Louisiana characters. They were from North Louisiana. I wanted to have a name that kind of spoke to Louisiana for me, and I've known quite a few Josephs growing up in Louisiana. I always just kind of liked the sound of that name without being maybe the more stereotypical last name, you know, the Thibodeaux and the Robichauds. And so that was just his last name. And then in the writing of it, I've kind of started to see it another way, and we have two brothers here, and the Joseph stories from the Old Testament kind of accidentally gave me certain inspirations for the story of these two brothers.
Right.
The one brother who's kind of lost and the other brothers who are searching, you know.
Well, it starts out definitely in Louisiana with one of the brothers working on an oil rig. And those passages are so detailed and interesting and kind of scary and horrifying all at the same time. What kind of research did you do to get that kind of veracity?
Well, you know, growing up in, you know, in South Louisiana, I guess you can't sort of not be around the oil industry. You know, I spent a lot of time as a kid and now fishing and duck hunting down in those areas, spent a lot of time in Grand Isle. So they were always out there, but they were certainly sort of alien to me. So to create those scenes, you know, a lot of research, a lot of speaking to people, and I'm also fortunate, one of my best friends from high school works out of Cut Off, Louisiana, in the oil industry. And so I tried to do all of my homework on the front end, write the book, write all the scenes, and then have put it in his hands and ask him, you know, what things am I getting wrong here? What things maybe could I layer in to make it feel even more real? So it's a combination, I guess, of experience and things I observed, probably more properly, and also leaning heavily on the folks I know who are a lot smarter than me when it comes to that.
I've been to Grand Isle recently, and it's one of my favorite places in Louisiana, you know? Now, this is such a quintessentially American story. It takes in such large forces, you know, as the oil business and the Gulf War, but it's also deeply personal family story about the way families can simply be blown apart and people can find themselves left on their own, kind of falling through the cracks. And yet it's not a very long book. You pack all these big, big themes into a relatively brief novel, which is an amazing achievement.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, so much of kind of the ideas I get for writing is, involves landscape and just moving my characters through landscape and having them interact with it. And, you know, in this book, I have Roy Joseph, the main character, strike out from Louisiana to San Francisco. And I guess in some ways, I think the best road novels, and that's just a portion of the book, but the best road trip in literature, they kind of take the temperature of the nation in certain ways. And so it was interesting to see that and like have him through Roy's eyes and see how he was sort of processing America as it is today, you know?
So what was the most interesting part of this book for you to write? That trip that Roy takes when he's off to California, and it is such a great American road trip. And the part where he stops to visit with a Navy SEAL named Lionel in Nevada, that part really got to me. There was that real sense of a complex, kind of threatening landscape.
I really enjoyed writing those sections. It's funny. I mean, a lot of it comes from place. I live in Tallahassee now, but I moved in 2006 from Louisiana, from Baton Rouge to San Francisco, and kind of made that drive. And one of the towns that I stopped over in was Battle Mountain, Nevada, where Lionel lives, where those scenes take place. And I just remember at the time, I think the Washington Post had voted the town the armpit of America.
Oh, just, God.
You know, so cruel, you know, and so East Coast. But to be fair, the person who wrote the article acknowledged that. But I really became interested in saying, well, there's got to be more than that here. And, like, who are these people? And I always knew, like, I wanted that to be one stop on his trip, you know. And as far as the part I enjoyed writing the most, you know, for me, the idea for the novel came while I was living in San Francisco and just being, you know, spending a lot of time with my dog, wandering around the city, trying to think of an idea for the next book to write. A lot of it sort of traced back to this image of, I don't know if you've been to San Francisco, but Sutro Tower, which sort of looks out over the entire city, this big TV tower, that to me, this kind of displaced southerner, looked a lot like an oil rig, you know, and we sort of process the unfamiliar with the familiar. And I don't know, I really think that that was the most interesting part for me. I mean, I do feel like it's a southern book in a lot of ways, but proportionally most of it takes place out of the south. But I have this southern main character in this kind of fish out of water situation. And it was really fun to sort of describe such a familiar city to so many people, San Francisco, but through the eyes of a newcomer and somebody that I think in certain ways, you know, sees and processes things in similar ways to me, you know.
Yeah, I went to San Francisco on my honeymoon, so it sort of felt kind of familiar to me, you know.
Uh-huh.
And also, you talk about walking around with your dog, and we should say there is a very memorable canine character in this book named Sam.
Yeah, I have great affection for my dog, who's a German wire-haired pointer named Jaeger. And, you know, I have this character who is essentially an orphan, you know, without many friends, and just sort of isolates himself But I wanted him to have a buddy, and it was great to write that. I don't think there are enough dogs in literature. I mean, they mean so much to the people who love them. And in a lot of ways, that dog is kind of his life raft for most of his life so far. And that was great. I really enjoyed just the scenes of sort of him and the dog just off on an adventure, like Travels with Charlie. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, keep them coming. Now, speaking in technical terms, where does this book fit into your journey as a writer? You know how they say every book teaches you how to write it. So you've done short fiction, you've done historical fiction, and now The Other Joseph, this story of brothers in contemporary America. So what did you learn from writing this particular book?
Well, with the story collection, a lot of that was all set in the Gulf South with mostly Southern characters. It was very close to, you know, writing what I know. Obviously, there's a lot of research that goes into that, but it was an exploration of the South and Southern people. I'll totally admit that. And then with the second one, I think I wanted to step further outside of myself, and so it was a historical novel and had an outsider, sort of an indigenous pygmy tribesman from Central Africa who winds up in the South. So it was kind of an exploration of the South and other things, but through the eyes of someone not of that world. And this is not intentional, but I can kind of see the trajectory. You know, I have an exploration of the outside world by a Southerner. So I feel like, you know, in some ways I've kind of exhausted the different combinations of that, but I'm not really trying to be formulaic about it either. I'm kicking around some different ideas for novels, and there's also a nonfiction project that I'm interested in. But I really don't know what direction I'm going to take with it. And I don't think I'm going to come at it intellectually either. Like, okay, this is the next step or in my formation I need to take. It's probably going to come from whatever, you know, D.L. Doctorow called it, whatever private excitement of the mind that happens to come along, you know, in the next few days or weeks or months. It makes me want to sort of sit down at a computer and tell another story. You know? And whenever people ask me, like, what are you working on next? I say, well, I think I'm still maybe on that private side of the fence.
Now, it fascinates me that you were a lawyer, a practicing lawyer for 5 years.
Nobody was fascinated by that when I was a lawyer.
But you didn't go the John Grisham route, I got to say.
I haven't, and I have nothing but respect for him, but I've never written directly about the law. And, you know, maybe an occasional lawyer character will pop up. But, you know, so much of good fiction is about conflict, and so much about law is about conflict that I think there's certainly overlaps, and I certainly see a lot of the work ethic and research that has to go into the fiction writing as being nurtured in large part from those days. But, you know, honestly, too, just the, I guess, a lot of litigation or, you know, presenting a case is telling a story. So I do think that there are some overlaps skill-wise, I mean, some significant ones. And so I'll admit that one day I do want to write something that, you know, sort of directly discusses and investigates that life, that world. But I've yet to kind of come upon the thing that to me seems real. You know? Mm-hmm.
And teaching is so much like it's explaining. It's making things clear to people much the way that lawyers do as well. And that's been a nice change for you, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it sounds like a job interview answer. And I've given it in job interviews. But I would say that, you know, my writing life definitely informs my teaching. My teaching life definitely informs our writing life. I mean, without that public outlet, I don't know what I would be like as a human being just walking around with a novel in my head all the time. You know, so much of being a writer is solitary that I really do enjoy these moments to kind of talk about this thing that I love without necessarily having to talk about my own work to other people who are kind of interested in reading and love to read and write. You know, that's been a real blessing.
I know. It's always fun to talk about the books we love to anyone who'll listen, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's like, wow, this is a group of people that care. It's sort of like being at Comic-Con or something.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we've been talking with Skip Horak, the author of the fun new novel, The Other Joseph. You can meet him Wednesday, March 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Skip, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. M.L. Walsh signs My Sunshine Away, and David Joy signs Where All the Light Tends to Go, Tuesday, March 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Maura Crone discusses and signs The Ice Garden, Tuesday, March 17th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Skip Horak, reads from and signs The Other Joseph, Wednesday, March 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Linnell Thomas signs Desire and Disaster in New Orleans, Tourism, Race, and Historical Memory, Wednesday, March 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. National Book Award-winning author Jessamyn Ward, author of Men We Reaped and Salvage the Bones, will present the 4th Annual Fry Lecture, sponsored by the New Orleans Center for the Gulf South, Thursday, March 19th at 7 at Tulane University's Woldenberg Art Center, Freeman Auditorium. She will discuss her writing process as it was shaped by storytelling and family oral traditions. Alice Abel Kemp discusses how grammar and punctuation errors can torpedo your manuscript. That's at the meeting of SOLA, the South Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America, Saturday, March 21st, from 10 to noon at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Whitney Stewart signs her new children's book, Meditation is an Open Sky, Saturday, March 21st at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Barry Bronston signs her new guidebook, Walking New Orleans, Sunday, March 22nd at 2 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet James Nolan, author of Drunk on Salt, and Gennaro Keeley Smith, author of The Land Baron's Son, read Sunday, March 22nd at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. S.J. Perricone signs Blue Steel Crucifix, Sunday, March 22nd at 3 at Garden District Bookshop. James Grissom signs Follies of God, Tennessee Williams and the Women of the Fog, Tuesday, March 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Historic New Orleans Collections exhibition, Purchased Lives, New Orleans and the Domestic Slave Trade, opens Tuesday, March 17th and is up through July 18th at the Williams Research Center. Saturday, March 21st, the collection will hold a conference called To Be Sold, The American Slave Trade from Virginia to New Orleans, in conjunction with the Library of Virginia and the Midlow Center at the University of New Orleans. Morning sessions will be held in Virginia and streamed live to New Orleans and vice versa in the afternoon. Speakers who will appear in New Orleans that afternoon include Walter Johnson, Lawrence Powell, Edward Baptist, Stephanie Jones Rogers, and today's guest, Adam Rothman. Go to hnoc.org for information. Start planning now for Edible Book Day at the New Orleans Museum of Art, the annual baking competition for cakes inspired by favorite books. There are several categories: funniest, punniest, most creative, most like a book, best visual presentation, as well as professional categories. Deadline for registration is March 20th. The annual competition takes place March 27th at 5:30 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Check out noma.org for more information. Plan ahead for the 29th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, which takes place March 25th through 29th at the Hotel Monteleone and many other venues around town. The complete schedule is up on the festival website, tennesseewilliams.net. Special guests this year include Williams biographer John Lahr, author of Tennessee Williams, The Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, filmmaker John Waters, best-selling author Laura Lippman, Rick Bragg, Amy Dickinson, Phil Klei, Yi-Yun Lee, and playwright Martin Sherman. Don't miss it. Saints and Sinners, the literary festival for LGBT writers and friends, takes place next weekend as well in conjunction with the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Check out sasfest.org for the complete schedule. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will hold their semi-annual Big Book Sale, March 26th through 29th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, March 26th through 28th from 10 to 8, and Sunday, March 29th from noon to 5. This is one of the largest book sales in the New Orleans area with more than 65,000 items for sale. And a big congratulations to Michael A. Ross, whose book, The Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case, Race, Law, and Justice in the Reconstruction Era, received the Kemper and Lila Williams Prize from the Louisiana Historical Association and the Historic New Orleans Collection for the best book on Louisiana history in 2014. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.